contact tracing, immigrant children, and remembering a South Florida sports legend. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Governor DeSantis is not a fan of contact tracing, but the state of Florida is spending millions on a contact tracing app with links to big donors. Also, there's a call to reopen the Childhood Detention Center in Homestead as thousands more children come across the border. One Democrat has broken ranks and wants to see the facility reopened. And the Miami Open is underway, but how are they keeping tennis players and fans safe as we continue to vaccinate the population? Finally,
that voice, you know, that baritone bass voice, beautiful.
We remember the University of Miami's legendary coach, Howard Schnellenberger. Sundial is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. States are using a multi-pronged strategy to limit the spread of COVID-19. Mandatory mask wearing, requiring social distancing, increasing testing sites, and contact tracing. Now, that last piece has been among the most difficult to implement successfully, and it's been expensive. Florida has invested at least $4 million into this method. Now, Governor Ron DeSantis is saying contact tracing isn't working, even though the state continues to pay a hefty sum to a contact tracing app developer. Tampa Bay Times political editor Steve Contorno has been following the story, and he joins us now. Steve, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So remind us, how does contact tracing work? What is it supposed to do?
Contact tracing is, you know, one of the oldest and, you know, tried and true methods of disease control. It's been used by public health agencies going back really centuries. It really involves interviewing someone who contracts a illness or disease or virus or bacteria in which the overall community wants to keep that from spreading. And what they'll do is they'll interview an individual, ask them questions about that can help them determine the source of the illness, and also help them build a list of contacts of people who they may have infected or passed along the virus to in the time between contraction and the interview. And so it's sort of a two-prong attack to trying to get your arms around an outbreak.
Yeah. And so at the beginning of this pandemic last year, I mean, so much talk about contact tracing, and then it faded away. Why? What happened?
Well, if you go back to the beginning of the pandemic, the Florida's system of public health departments had been gutted for really over a decade by previous administrations, especially under Governor Rick Scott. It was one of the most effective public health agencies really in the country, and a series of cuts left the departments really understaffed. And as a result, when the pandemic reached Florida, there wasn't necessarily the bodies in place to quickly implement the kind of contact tracing you would like to see to understand the scope of the outbreak in your community. Florida responded by basically overnight trying to hire and bring on hundreds and by mid-summer, thousands of people across the state to assist in this effort. But by that time, there was already a lot of community spread, and it would be very difficult to do contact tracing where you're trying to stop a disease from spreading by getting a list of someone's contacts, especially since this virus too, it could take several days before you start showing symptoms and the number of people you may have come in contact with during that time,
right?
Grows. So
it's one of those things you can't catch up on. It's you have to jump on it very quickly. Florida did invest in some contact tracing tools. The state's Department of Health started with this tracing application. It was called Stronger Than C19. I'd never downloaded it. What can you tell us about it?
It was a pretty rudimentary application. It's for those of us who have been dealing with smartphones for quite some time now and are very versed in applications, it was pretty stripped down. It was basically a series of questions that you can voluntarily answer about, you know, if you have symptoms or if you've recently traveled. It basically went through a series of questions that you could answer, and that data would go back to the state. It's not clear what the state was doing with that data. You know, I've talked to some folks who say that they don't believe that there's anyone on staff in the Department of Health who has the ability to even use that data. But essentially, that was their first attempt at creating a mobile app. It was just basically a survey that you could voluntarily choose to answer.
And how much did that cost the state?
That cost about $400,000. And as far as I can tell from the Apple Store ratings and the number of downloads, not many people used it.
All right. Then there was a second one. This one was called Healthy Together. Why do we need a second one? I'm going to take it was better, but why do we need a second one? Was there a need?
This is a question that I've put to the state, and I haven't been able to get an answer of why the need for a second app was created and what they hope to get out of it. I do know that the company behind Healthy Together was initially brought on to help create a back system CMS for contact tracing for all the thousands of people that were hired. There wasn't really a central place for them to put the information they were collecting. And so this company behind Healthy Together created a back system CMS for the state to collect this data that it was suddenly producing by the thousands.
You know, we know that the state intentionally reduced communication about COVID-19 in the lead up to the November election. Is it possible that Floridians were just unaware of these tools and that's why they're unsuccessful?
It certainly was noticeable that the Healthy Together application, unlike the Stronger Than C19 app, was never announced by the state in a press release. You can get a text message after you get a test result that encourages you to download it. But this partnership with the company behind Healthy Together, it's a company called 20 Labs, wasn't really announced by the state, and there's really no information about it on their website. And, you know, perhaps if there was a stronger public information outreach campaign around these tools, it is possible that they could have gotten more use out of them.
So we have these apps, but the governor, he's not a big fan of contact tracing. Has that always been the case, or is that his beliefs on this evolved? And I guess have these apps, you know, played a role in how he thinks about contact tracing?
So, yeah, Governor DeSantis didn't talk much about contact tracing early in the pandemic, just to sort of acknowledge it was something that they were going to do. Around the time he was talking about reopening up the state, he spoke as contact tracing would be one of the pillars of Florida's operation as it sought to reopen businesses and get people moving again. But then around July, he started to sort of sour on the idea. You know, a lot of the outbreak in Florida was being tied to younger people and some, you know, gatherings of large parties and at bars and such. And he basically kind of said, you know, contact tracing, it's really hard to do when you got a bunch of kids who are, you know, asymptomatic and or have not showing a lot of symptoms, and they don't want to answer your calls and they don't respond to your surveys. So it hasn't been very effective. You know, we're going to keep doing it, but, you know, just be forewarned, we're not seeing very good results from it. More recently, he has completely soured on it and has essentially said it was ineffective and was never going to work in a pandemic situation like coronavirus.
So something interesting, our senior producer recently went to New York, and he said that he was called daily by reps from the State Department of New York, Department of Health, that, and they were asking for his condition, his updates on his condition. Does that exist in Florida? Do we do anything like that?
This is something we've been trying to get an understanding of from the beginning, what exactly Florida's contact tracing methodology is. Several experts I spoke to say that the state doesn't really have a strategy. I have heard from people who said that they were never contacted by the state, or they were contacted several days or weeks after they even took the step of notifying the state that they had a positive test. Especially early on, there were folks who said it took quite a bit of time for the state and the public health department to reach out to them. So It's definitely, from what I've heard from people who have experienced it, if you get a call, sometimes it'll come days or weeks later, and it's not nearly as thorough, and there's not a lot of follow-up. They're kind of just doing what they can to sort of go through a list of questions and log it.
Yeah. And just want to clarify here, my producer does not have COVID. He just traveled and they were calling daily to see if he had symptoms, but still daily. I'm talking with Tampa Bay Times political editor Steve Contorno. We're talking about Florida's investments in contact tracing. Governor DeSantis has said it doesn't work, but his administration has already paid $4 million and is continuing to pay a hefty sum to contact tracing app developers. You can find more of Steve's reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Steve, we come back to this Healthy Together app. How much did that one cost?
To date, the state has paid about $4 million to Healthy Together for the app and other services like that CMS they set up. And the payments have been as recently as late March. In fact, the week that DeSantis sort of made this announcement, where he suggested contact tracing was not effective, that same week, the state sent $200,000 to 20 labs for this contact tracing application.
What else do we know about the developer of the app and how he got this job?
So the developer is a company called 20 Labs, which previously had created a app called 20, which is like a social meetup, but in person kind of app. It was, you know, trying to get people to meet in person versus just having interactions online. When coronavirus hit, they shifted gears to creating an app called Healthy Together. It launched in Utah. Around the time it launched, it actually got a shout out from former Vice President Mike Pence during a coronavirus briefing at the White House. That was around April. And then 2 months later, they have a contract with Florida. They really had no previous relationship with the state, and the state couldn't give us very much information about why they hired this company, whether they were chosen over other companies, and what sort of procurement process they went through.
And, you know, they got this was a no-bid emergency contract, but what's the state law say about competitive bids for state contracts?
Typically, there is a process that the state has to go through when it wants to award a contract to an outside company. It usually involves putting out the bid for solicitation, getting back multiple bids, having a panel rate the companies based off of their price and their history with the state and all sorts of other factors. And then a company is chosen based off of that sort of matrix and rubric. That was not the case that we went through for this app. It was instead chosen with an emergency because, you know, during the pandemic, the state had to spend a lot of money very quickly in order to respond to the crisis. So the governor has used his emergency authority in order to spend really billions of dollars at this point without going through that normal procurement process.
What's the connection to the former President Trump?
So the company that created Healthy Together is 20 Labs, and the son of the company the company's founder, his father is a hedge fund manager based in Palm Beach. And this individual is also a Trump donor. He helped this company created the app, or right before they started getting contracts, the founder's father held a fundraiser for Trump at his Palm Beach estate, in which a couple had to pay $500,000 for dinner. And that was one of the more expensive fundraisers of President Trump's reelection campaign.
So what has DeSantis said about this link to the president, to the fact that he doesn't like contact tracing, yet they're still spending money on this app? What's his response?
So when we asked his office about, first off, why they continue to spend money on an app that doesn't work, they just told us that they continue to use the data that they receive from both apps to help guide their response, and that they are constantly evaluating what are the most effective strategies for containing the virus. As far as how this company was chosen and any connection with the president or the former president, you know, I sort of asked whether or not the state had any conversations with anyone in the White House or former Vice President Pence, since he was, you know, discussing it. And their response was essentially that there was no sort of political influence that went into the selection of this company.
What do we do now? You've talked to experts. What do they say Florida should be doing now?
I think one thing that they want to stress is that contact tracing can work, and it has been very effective in other parts of the world. In Thailand, you know, in Bangkok, with a population of 10 million people, from all reports, contact tracing was a pretty vital component of their strategy toward containing the virus, and it was very effective. I think that they would like to see Florida have a more comprehensive strategy. You're not going to necessarily stop an outbreak with contact tracing alone. However, you can figure out where there are hotspots in your state, especially if there are hotspots related to certain variants, and focusing efforts on being proactive in helping people who may have been in contact with someone who has coronavirus, give them the information that they need. Those kind of conversations can be really effective in mitigating how much it can spread.
Steve Contorno is a political reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. You can find more of his reporting on this story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Steve, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, there is a push to reopen the child detention center in Homestead. You may be surprised who wants to reopen it. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border continues to worsen. Government estimates show roughly 18 to 20,000 children could cross the border in April alone. Ongoing violence in Central American countries, combined with COVID-19's devastating impact on Latin American economies, has left tens of thousands of children fleeing their homes. What we do with these children remains a difficult question, especially for the Biden administration. Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, a Democrat, recently broke with her party in suggesting the Homestead Temporary Shelter for Unaccompanied Minors should be reopened after it was closed for lacking a proper hurricane evacuation plan. We reached out to Ms. Wilson. Her press secretary said the Congresswoman is not available to do this interview. Well, joining us now is Alex Dougherty, reporter for the Miami Herald and McClatchy, based in Washington, D.C. Alex, great to have you back.
Thank you.
We talked with you when the Miami Herald uncovered a job posting for positions at this detention facility. And since that conversation, just back in February, where do things stand on the reopening?
So in terms of what the public knows, not much. We're hearing rumblings about this center and other facilities around the country being ready to take in immigrant children. But in terms of any kind of official announcements or movement on the ground in Homestead, we have not seen any formal announcements or acknowledgement.
And nothing from the Biden administration on this?
No, not at all.
Why does Congresswoman Wilson believe the facility should be the space to house unaccompanied children who were detained at the border? What has she said, or what do we know?
So her position on this is rooted from what you said in your opening, which is, there's thousands of immigrant children who are coming across the border, especially in the last few months since Biden was inaugurated. The existing facilities that are run by Customs and Border Patrol, which are ultimately controlled by the Department of Homeland Security, are currently full. Part of that is related to COVID and the limits on social distancing, but also more so the thousands of people coming across. So there's this problem, and Frederica Wilson is saying, hey, look, you know, I think this is imperfect, but this should be part of the solution. Let's reopen this facility, which in 2019 was the largest such facility in the country for unaccompanied migrant children.
If they're going to certain facilities right now and those facilities get full, then what do they do with the extra kids? Are they being deported, or where else are they going?
So most of the children are not being deported if they are coming across unaccompanied. We're seeing a lot of families and adults who would be applying for asylum or attempting to stay in the United States once they cross are being deported by the Biden administration. Children are the exception to that. And that is where the problem in terms of housing them and what to do with them lies. And so once they are in federal government custody, initially by Customs and Border Patrol, they're then transferred to facilities like Homestead that are ultimately under the control of the Department of Housing and Human Services, or Health and Human Services, as they attempt to find a family member or sponsor in the United States to take that child in. That process usually takes a number of weeks. Obviously, they don't want to just release a kid to someone who they haven't vetted. So they, you know, need to make sure that, you know, this family member is in fact a family member and they can take care of this child and things like that. And that's where these, you know, centers like Homestead come into play.
Do we know if Representative Wilson visited the facility in Homestead and understands what some advocates' concerns were about conditions?
Yes. So she visited the facility and is on record back in 2019 criticizing the way that facility was run and the way access was given to that facility. Her argument is that Joe Biden's position on immigration and compassion toward immigrants compared to Donald Trump is what makes her more comfortable with this facility reopening. So she understands the concerns, the ongoing concerns that a lot of activists have, but she has visited the facility and says that because Biden is now in charge, that he will make sure the agencies are being run in ways that, you know, make the center more transparent and accountable. I think a lot of advocates still see things a bit differently, though.
All right. And she's also argued that local leaders should be responsible for, you know, the health standards. But we know, you know, local lawmakers like former Congresswoman Debbie McCarthy Powell, they couldn't even access the building. I mean, what are the challenges for accountability, considering that's it's federally run or privately run?
Right. So there were definitely a number of challenges with accountability when the facility was first opened. Lawmakers tried for weeks to get in and were not able to. I would imagine that Wilson thinks that the Biden administration will give more access to lawmakers, immigration attorneys, and other advocates who may want to get inside to, you know, view how things are going and to make sure that it's being run in a humane way. But yes, that's still a definite open question because there are no children at this facility currently, so there's no reason for anyone to need to see it. But if it were staffed up rather quickly, I think there are questions as to whether HHS would again limit access in the way that it did under Trump.
Again, talking with Alex Stockerty, reporter, political reporter for McClatchy, based in Washington, D.C., Democratic Congresswoman Frederica Wilson has called for the reopening of the Homestead Childhood Detention Facility, breaking with members of her own party. You can read more of Alex's reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Alex, we remember, you know, Democratic presidential candidates, including now VP Kamala Harris, campaigned heavily against this facility, and they visited back in 2019. They were outside the wall. Harris now responsible for overseeing the crisis, this crisis for the administration. How have Democrats navigated the issue as that crisis at the border gets worse?
Right. So it's tough on a number of levels. First, you have this issue of children crossing the border and capacity concerns and security concerns associated with that. And kind of concurrently, you have Joe Biden wanting to overhaul US immigration law with the help of Democrats and is facing opposition from Republicans. That would involve things like giving undocumented immigrants, dreamers, temporary protected status holders, pathways to citizenship or permanent residency. And those two things are kind of playing out on a dual track. But what we're seeing, and where Homestead fits into this, is under the first problem, which is all of these children who are coming across the border and the lack of the federal government to be able to house them adequately. And so that's where we're seeing a split between Wilson and a number of Democrats who, you know, local Democrats since February have said, hey, look, we cannot reopen the center because under Trump, it was run by a for-profit contractor that had all sorts of associated issues. And there's not really any assurances that this facility would be run in any meaningful way if it were needed to open rather quickly, as it probably will be, to help with the surge of migrant children at the border.
Representative Wilson met with the chair of the Democratic Party, as well as activist Thomas Kennedy. And we heard from Kennedy this morning. This is what he said about his conversation with her.
To us, it is completely unacceptable that the Homestead detention camp for children is going to be reopened. We have to remember that this is a facility that is next to a military waste site, a Superfund site, with a possible toxicity of the soil. It's really a health hazard. It's vulnerable to hurricanes and extreme weather events. And the for-profit component of the site, it's run by private contractors that make hundreds of million dollars a year, really opens up for the abuse of the children and the retaining of the children in these facilities in prison-like conditions for long periods of time. So we're really looking for the Congresswoman and the Biden administration and other parties responsible to look for alternatives to this facility, mainly home-like shelters, not prison-like conditions.
All right. So, I mean, are activists like Kennedy even being heard in Congress? Are they playing a role in this discussion?
So most other elected Democrats in South Florida have a position that is similar to Kennedy's and have since February, when the reporting first came out that this facility might reopen, definite concerns with the for-profit contractor aspect of this, for sure, from most Democrats. What Wilson is saying is, hey, look, like, this is not a good situation. It's not an ideal situation. And places like Miami have an obligation to step up and help immigrants who are trying to come here, you know, be able to stay in some kind of conditions. But Kennedy's point is like, look, like, this facility in particular is a symbol of everything that Democrats felt was wrong with Trump's administration's immigration policies, and reopening it under Biden with, you know, the environmental concerns that he just mentioned, along with, you know, the hurricane concerns. Most of these children were housed in tents that could not withstand any kind of tropical event, you know, makes it for him like, you know, let's try to find ways to put these children into smaller facilities, you know, that are more, like he said, house-like, rather than a larger facility that can house hundreds or even thousands of children.
Well, the call by Congresswoman Wilson to reopen this facility comes as the Biden administration continues to deport immigrant adults and families. How are Florida's congressional Democrats responding to those deportations?
Yeah, and that's the interesting part of this, is that all of South Florida's Democrats in Congress, Wilson included, have written to Biden's Department of Homeland Security secretary saying they need to stop those deportations, which are currently being justified under a Trump-era law that allows the Biden administration to deport a lot of folks seeking asylum. That also includes a lot of Haitians, which obviously has importance to South Florida, but primarily where we're seeing at the border, it's folks from the Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, that are being deported back to their countries along with some Mexicans. And so that's a big issue. And it's certainly not a very convenient question for the Biden administration to answer. But on that issue, the Congresswoman, along with other South Florida Democrats, are all asking Biden to change that policy.
Now, what about the congressional Republicans here in South Florida? Maria Elvira Salazar, Carlos Jimenez, what have they said about the deportations? What have they said about Biden's approach to this?
So the Republican objections to this nationwide are twofold. One being that Biden needs to do more to physically secure the border, whether that means building a border fence, spending more money on border enforcement to prevent people from crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. That's one piece of it. And the second piece of it is that they think, you know, Biden is not really attempting to deal with the number of people that do get across in a way that's effective, whether that is changing laws or whether that is, you know, again, through enforcement. And so you've seen a lot of congressional Republicans, Salazar and Jimenez included, traveling to the U.S.-Mexico border in the last month to make that very point. You know, Democrats are arguing that we need to be compassionate. And in the case of South Florida's Democrats, even more open to immigrants than what we're currently seeing. And Joe Biden's kind of in the middle of all this, you know, wanting to, you know, help immigrants and, you know, wanting to deal with the root causes of immigration in Central America. But as Congresswoman Wilson noted in an interview with me yesterday, I think it's true that those root causes that cause people to come to the border are not going to be solved in a matter of weeks. And that's where she's at of like, hey, you know, opening Homestead is something that could happen in a matter of weeks.
Yeah.
That at least gives us a short-term solution to this problem.
And briefly, I mean, we're just a few months into the Biden administration, but how do you compare to what Trump was doing on immigration?
Yeah, so again, this is an issue where the rhetoric is certainly very different and the political signaling around the issue is very different. But in terms of policy, it's actually largely the same, at least when it comes to the U.S.-Mexico border at this point. Biden did reverse the Trump policy of separating families and their children at the border. But in this case, families are mostly just getting deported just altogether. And so it's definitely a challenge. And, you know, we're seeing Biden talking about immigration in a way that is very different than Donald Trump. But currently, in terms of how the border is operating, you know, there's definitely a lot of changes that kind of remain to be seen.
Alex Stockerty, the Washington, D.C.-based reporter for the Miami Herald and McClatchy, read his work on this issue on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Alex, thank you for the insight.
Thank you.
And by the way, you can stay in touch with us via the new text club that we have. It's a Sundial text club because we'd love to hear your thoughts on issues like this one. You can find many different ways to be a part of the show, and this is one of them. Just text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, hello to 786-677-0767. We'd love to hear what you think about programs like this one, especially segments like that one. Still to come, are you watching the Miami Open? It's a completely different experience with COVID, and we'll explain coming up. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the Miami Open is well underway with some of the greatest tennis players across the globe at the Hard Rock Stadium. Hometown star Naomi Osaka has made her way to the quarterfinals. South Florida is home to a number of elite tennis stars. They migrate to Palm Beach and Broward County for year-round warm weather and trainers. Why wouldn't you? Well, the tournament was forced to adapt this year because of COVID-19. Last week, we spoke with Donna Kelso, tour supervisor for the Women's Tennis Association, about what this year's event looks like. You were in Indian Wells in California last year in March when everything had to stop. All of a sudden, the world stopped. What was that like?
Absolutely.
What was happening? How did you find out, and what was that like?
It was a very, very surreal experience. I was in Indian Wells as the lead WTA supervisor. So I arrived a couple of days in advance, as we normally would, getting into the tournaments that we're working. And we had already started putting protocols in place. We're having meetings as to, for example, what the ball kids were to do on court, not touching towels, etc., putting safety and sanitization protocols in place. And from what I can recall, there was a positive case determined in the Coachella Valley area, and the medical advisors for the event met and deemed that if there was to be an outbreak, then perhaps as good as the medical facilities are, with the number of players, coaches, staff, and especially spectators coming to that area, that we could be in, you know, for a challenge.
So we've seen the world slowly trying to get back to normal, especially when you talk about sports. We have sports, but there's limitations on how players and coaches and staff and volunteers can move around. And obviously when it comes to fans, very few fans can be in the stands, not what we're used to. But what are the protocols for this tournament?
So everybody who is part of the tournament needs to test before coming into the controlled environment. And then for those that are in the inner functional group, which comprises the players and their team members and those who are working directly with the athletes, we're all tested every 4 days. We can only travel between the nominated hotels and the venue and nowhere else. So it is a little bit challenging. However, these the rules that we need to abide to if we want to continue this sport.
What's that done to the mental health for everybody, not just the players, but everybody? Because as you said, you're only allowed to go from one place to the other and back and forth, and you cannot go anywhere else because you'd be putting yourself at risk. And I mean, this is South Florida and you see the weather and it's beautiful. That's going to be hard when you're like, I'm stuck just doing this.
Yeah, we're fortunate to have a spectacular venue here at the Hard Rock Stadium. It's actually my first time visiting this venue, as familiar as I am with the beautiful Key Biscayne. You know, saving grace in, you know, not having a tennis court on the football field means that the football field is open for players to be able to, you know, warm up, practice, hang out, you know, in the fresh air, and the site is quite vast. So there is a lot of space here for players to maintain distance and still to go about their, you know, their daily routines.
How many fans are allowed in? I mean, this is a tournament that last year, I believe, you know, when you or in past years, you could have up to 400,000 over the 2 weeks, but you're limited to what? How many?
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't know the exact numbers. However, I do know that spectators wishing to come to the tournament need to purchase a seat for whether it's a grandstand court or court number one, or they don't necessarily, they can view very limited tennis on the outside courts. The seats around the grandstand court for spectators have been very, very clearly identified to maintain distance between the spectators and also, you know, the athletes.
You've had the chance to walk around and you know, see how things are set up. I mean, look, that's one of the beauties of live tennis is having the fans. And I don't, what's it like? What's it like when you have very few and you don't hear the noises you're used to?
It is quite different. I think we're hearing that a lot from the players. However, we're thankful to have fans, to have spectators here in the stands. There have been a number of tournaments played in different parts of the world since we did return to play last July, August, where there were no fans. So to have at least a limited percentage of spectators in the stands adds to the atmosphere, and cross our fingers that it can only hope to continue to grow in numbers of spectators permitted on site.
We're talking with Donna Kelso, Tour Supervisor of the Women's Tennis Association. She's also the director of the WTA University. She's at the Hard Rock Stadium for this year's Miami Open Tournament, and things a bit different because of the pandemic. Only a limited number of fans are allowed in every day so that they can practice social distancing. You know, I'm just wondering for you, and I'm curious about how female players feel. You know, tennis is one of those sports where you're traveling around the world for events. You have the Australian Open just recently. Now you're here. You got England and France for the big events. I mean, it's a lot of travel. Do the players feel that the tennis associations are doing as much as possible to keep everybody safe, or are there issues that still need to be fixed?
I would like to say that on the WTA Tour, who I work for, we have got a very intricate, detailed plan in place, which we started working on pretty much from when the tennis world shut down in March last year. So we do have a lot of protocols working very closely with organizations such as the Mayo Clinic in CDC compliance. Everywhere we go, we work very closely with the local health authorities. The amount of cleaning and sanitizing around the venue, in the vehicles, on court is very, very strict. So in terms of making the environment safe for the players, we're doing that, you know, as much as we can to very minute detail. And the protocols in terms of, you know, arriving in advance of the event, complying with the testing, I mean, our medical department and medical advisors have been working nonstop to provide the best environment and the best care for those athletes to be able to continue to do what they love.
You know, I noticed that college football has already, not all schools, but some of the bigger schools like the University of Alabama and some other big ones in the South have already said that in the fall, come fall, August, September, they are going to allow full stands. So you're talking about tens of thousands of people per game. What are the conversations right now about when tennis believes that it can open back up and let everybody back in?
It's all up to the individual country or city where the tournament is being held. So, for example, being from Australia, working the Australian Open, we were fortunate to have, a considerable number of spectators, up to 50%. During the latter rounds when, after we had weathered the 5-day shutdown in the middle of the Australian Open. Again, some events last year and also the beginning of this year have been able to have limited capacity, maybe up to 50%, maybe up to 25%. But we all defer to the local health authorities on that.
Let me finish with this. Maybe this is just the pandemic, but, you know, some tournaments, you have big name players who are not showing up. And in this one, we have that. We have some very big male players who are not here. Serena Williams is not here. Is it just because of the pandemic? And, I mean, that's got to hurt, you know, the smaller tournaments, you know, compared to the Grand Slams when these superstars aren't here.
I would say no, it's not necessarily because of the pandemic, because we've seen over the years where, sadly, an individual athlete may be recovering from an injury or an illness, and being the elite athletes as they are, they want to ensure that they are performing at their highest possible level. Sometimes we'll see events where all of the top 100 players show up, and then there are others that are sadly more affected than others in terms of the number of high-profile players who have to withdraw.
That was Donna Kelso, tour supervisor for the Women's Tennis Association. Again, the Miami Open underway right now. Well, staying on the topic of sports, we're going to end today's program remembering an iconic individual in this community. What's the first thing that comes to mind when I say Howard Schnellenberger? Is it that pipe that he always had in between his lips? Or maybe it was that baritone voice with that southern drawl. Did you enjoy that? Maybe it was all the winning he did when he was with the Miami Dolphins and the University of Miami. Well, the legendary coach passed away this weekend, and I spoke with Miami Herald sports reporter Susan Degnan, who covers the Hurricanes football team. She has some really interesting memories about the old coach.
He's just a treasure. I mean, he was just a treasure. Every time anyone had the, you know, honor to meet him, he... that voice, you know, that baritone, bass, whatever voice, beautiful, so deep. You couldn't be, you were held captive by it. The mustache, you know, the thick mustache, the sincerity. He was very in tune with whomever he was, you know, talking to, and really down to earth and honest and frank and very funny. He told you what he felt. He did have a big ego, but he was real honest and a great psychologist, I guess you could say. He convinced a lot of great kids to go to the University of Miami. He's just I love talking to him.
You know, he came at a time when the team was actually being considered for being disbanded. It was such a terrible team. But what was it about him that he could foster so much support and confidence in the school and in players and everybody around him to build a winner?
His vision, his thoughts, what, you know, he was convincing. He made a list for the administration of, you know, the football program's assets and liabilities, because UM, I guess, had been talking about dropping down to Division I AA. And I think he went to the administration, and this, I took this out of Barry Jackson's obituary, but it's amazing. And he said that, again, what the school considered liabilities were actually strengths. Well, the first thing he said was UM had the greatest stadium in the South in the Orange Bowl. And the administration, of course, thought that was the worst stadium. It was too big. It wasn't on campus. Okay. But Howard said, nope, it's the best. And the second thing he said was that UM had, you know, the best schedule a college team could have. They played Notre Dame, Florida, Florida State, Penn State. Everyone knows that that's a great thing if you're building a program. I mean, you might get beat a few times, but you also might pull off some upsets, which, of course, Schnellenberger did. And, of course, the administration thought, no, that's a bad thing. We need to play weaker teams, right? And then the third thing he said was that the state, you know, Howard created the state of Miami, quote unquote, which was the South Florida, which was the state of Miami was Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach County. And that's where he did his amazing recruiting. He just did everything he said he was going to do, but that's how he kind of worked his way in. And whatever Howard said, he was convincing.
He was. I remember when he went to help build the football program at Florida Atlantic University. And I talked to him, you know, over a span of years, I talked to him a few times. And he was convinced that he could turn them into a national champion. But why didn't he succeed as much there?
Howard Schnellenberger, first of all, he gets this great stadium built, which, I mean, UM played there, and, you know, and I covered a game there, and it's a beautiful stadium. And it's that he could do that, number one, was incredible. And, you know, the Owls were in Division I AA before he transition them into the FBS, which is, you know, the major college football, which, you know, University of Miami plays in. And FAU started playing in 2001. And within 2 years, Lewis, they made it to the national semifinals of the Division I AA before losing.
Yeah. And I don't want to make it sound like he didn't have success. He built a team from scratch and built the stadium and helped, you know, create a very successful program. Obviously, he had said to me, we'll win a national championship in my lifetime. And I always thought, all right, coach, well, you know, I'd love to see that day. When you think about mm-hmm. the great athletes and great coaches from South Florida, how should we remember his legacy?
Extremely caring, extremely respectful, loved his family so much, which to me is fantastic. You're a football coach. You never hear about the other stuff. A winner in all respects.
And that he definitely was. That was Miami Herald sports reporter Susan Degnan, who covers the Hurricanes football team. You know, how are you going to remember Coach Schnellenberger? Find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Tell us your favorite memory. How should we remember him? Maybe a statue, maybe a street name, maybe name the stadium after him. Who knows? Well, mine, I got to tell you, I did meet him. As I said in the interview there, I met him a few years ago. He did tell me, I'm no joke, he said, Lewis, in my lifetime, that's a terrible Howard Schnellenberger, the Owls will win the national championship. Coach, I hope they do. I really do. Well, that's Sundial for this Tuesday, March 30th. Sundial senior producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Odalis Garcia is filling in as a producer this week. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Saria Reimer is our intern. Our news director is Taryn Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zabka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. The theme music for the show is from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo, at gopalo.com. Don't forget the program re-airs tonight at 8, or find us on your podcast app and just listen to the podcast. Well, coming up tomorrow on the show, do you have solar panels? Are you interested in getting them? Solar has long been an option in Florida, but our market remains behind California, North Carolina, Texas. We're going to have a panel discussion tomorrow about the future of solar energy here in Florida. And if you're interested in solar, perhaps you've had it for a while, we'd like to hear from you. Text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. You can also email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. We're going to do our best to include your comments and questions in the discussion. But again, if you have solar or if you want it, tell us about that. Tell us about what it's been like living with solar energy, or if you have a question, what would that be? Also tomorrow, a Boca Raton councilman is cleaning up his city one street at a time. We're going to learn about his campaign to jog through every nook and cranny of Boca Raton, meet with residents, and clean up trash at the same time. It's a really interesting story. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. We'll talk to you again live tomorrow.